Welcome to the Chelan County Board of Directors meeting. It's July 23rd, approximately 10 a.m. We're struggling with time this morning, and all of us commissioners seem to have levelized that. If you have a cell phone, please put it in a position that it won't disturb the meeting. I'd appreciate that. And welcome to our guest today. Given the opportunity for you to address the commission, we'll give you that opportunity and structure that in a way in which it will be productive, but not overly lengthy. With that being said, we have three commissioners present. Randy Smith is on the phone. Is that correct, Randy?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. And Gary Arsenault is in Washington, D.C., representing us at the Policymakers Conference for APPA. So with that being said, off we go. We'll start with the Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute. And Michelle Dennis, love the last name.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. I am Michelle Dennis, and I am the Fiber and Telecom Administrative Assistant. So for those of you who have pools in your backyard, or who might be visiting a friend who has a pool, just a few things to remember. Keep a close watch on kids. Drowning is still the second leading cause of preventable death in children 15 and under. This group is also the most at risk for drowning in a pool or a spa, with 74% of those drownings occurring in a residential location. So for those of you who do have a pool at your home, the Pool Safely campaign urges all adults and children to take the Pool Safely Pledge. And once you've signed this pledge, they will mail you a pool safety toolkit. And already 75,000 people have signed this pledge this summer. So a few tips to help keep kids safe. Drowning is usually silent. It's not typically the thrashing and yelling for help like you see in the movies. Never leave a child alone near water. If you have to go somewhere, take the child with you or assign a new adult to take watch. Also, if a lifeguard is present, they are helpful, but also keep in mind they're not a babysitter. Always keep an eye on your kid. And do not let children play around the drains or suction fittings. Also, if a child goes missing, make sure to check the water first. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, comments?
No, it's just nice to see you here. We haven't seen you at a board meeting before.
Yeah, it's the first one.
Yeah. Nice job.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. Let's take a look at the agenda. Any items that you would like to place on the consent agenda? Hearing none, the consent agenda will stand as it is. And let's talk about Suzanne Hartman.
Let's do that. Okay. So, commissioners, I just want to make you aware. Suzanne, could you come on up for a second?
Yeah, actually, Suzanne, we're going to talk about you in front of you today. Just giving you that.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the Public Relations Society of America recently announced the election of 11 new members into the organization's prestigious College of Fellows. You might consider it the Hall of Fame of public relations folks. And we're proud to say that Suzanne was nominated and was elected into this great organization. So we all know Suzanne is an incredible workhorse. Right? She is somebody who just gets a tremendous amount of work done and does it with a great deal of class and represents us incredibly well. So we're just pleased to see that other people outside of the district are recognizing her the way that we feel that is deserved. So Suzanne,
you.
Congratulations to you.
Yeah, congratulations.
Nice. Congratulations.
Wow.
Yeah.
The induction ceremony will be in Austin, Texas in October. So they say that it's a black tie event. However, since it's in Austin, you're allowed to wear your cowboy boots. So I'm going to get out my jewel-covered cowgirl boots and show up. So, but thank you. It is quite an honor. And something that, you know, you never think about doing your job, but it's pretty nice to be recognized. Mm-hmm. So, thank you.
It is. And by your fellows, that is so, I think, so important and so rewarding.
It's not an easy process. Once you get nominated, that's the easy part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the telling them what you've done to get to this point, and then that's the harder part.
It is.
Remember all those things.
Yeah. So. But anyway, congratulations. We're very proud of you and your work. Thank you for your presence here, your contributions. And then we will be with Bev Freeman around 11:45.
Right. A little bit before noon.
And then I would like to share with the commission and with the recorded audience and the people present a nice letter from Jean Sherratt, who is working to help develop the Hydro Academy. And says, Dear President Wills and Chelan County PUD commissioners, I would like to take a moment to write a short note that I hope you will find long and on appreciation for your recent decision to authorize and approve of a bridging agreement that provides foundation for forming the Hydro Research Institute. This significant agreement allows for appointment of directors and for the filing of articles of incorporation necessary to move this visionary concept forward. As noted in the press release, Chelan County PUD will be a leader in collecting and compiling operating data for hydroelectric generators and coordination of analysis and research on operations with potential to reduce costs, increase revenues by reducing forced outages, develop new sensor technology and monitors to improve predictive capabilities. Truly, this is a visionary approach to improve efficiencies and advancement of the application of technology. My congratulations for the vision required to initiate such a transformative concept and leadership necessary to bring the Hydro Project Institute concept to fruition. Your efforts are recognized and appreciated and valued in the community. Thanks for making us all so proud. Great work, greatly appreciated, Jean Sherratt. And it is one thing to have a nice letter directed to the commission, but we all know where the legs of this project came from. And it's from, you know, Kirk Hudson and staff that have seen the wisdom of this project and the diligence to follow it through. And I guess one of the most exciting things to me is that the concept, this is growing and the application of it is really widespread. And so one of the things that we have had a desire to be as an innovative organization, and this certainly speaks well to that. So, Kirk, to you and everyone who's been working with you, to Steve for your leadership, our appreciation very much.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. And Gene's not a lightweight when he weighs in on something, so very appreciative of his letter. Quarterly balance scorecard.
This is the board balance scorecard. Excuse me.
So, Commissioner Congdon, up first.
Yeah, I see nothing exceptional here, so I can pass this on. Look, Gary's not here. Pass this on to you, Dennis, I believe.
Yeah, that was quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would give the same.
Maybe we should do a little brief statement of what we're talking about.
Well, you know what? I believe you're right.
All right, you want to back up to me?
Sure.
Yeah.
Steve, you weren't with us when we used to go through this every single time, every single objective. And so so it's kind of nice to not have to do that. But the stakeholder section of this is sustain our public partnership. And that appears at the top. Oh, there it is. You can see it up on the screen. That appears at the top of our balance scorecard because basically that's getting our attention. That gets the most attention and basically. And if you look at the objectives and then look at our target and our year to date, we're meeting our objectives. That's the goal. So I have nothing to report. Right. other than we're on target, I think.
Yeah, and I'll cover Gary's real quickly. Gary maintains strong financial stewardship. This organization has great strength in that area, and that continues to play out. And very appreciative of being financially where we are, and particularly when you compare this institution to approximately 3,300 other public utilities in the United States, and bond rating wise, et cetera, we're in the top five. That's pretty unique positioning. So that's just kind of a summary statement, I think, of where we are successfully at this point. And again, congratulations to our staff to get us there. Effective execution. There's nothing here that would draw attention in terms of not meeting the goals or objectives. And Randy Smith, approved strategy and business planning.
You bet. Following in the same theme that you've been currently talking, the strategy and business planning, we conduct every spring workshop. We talk about it, and we did that review in our February meeting, and the annual strategic planning goals that we've received, we reviewed in January. The only item on the strategy and business planning that has yet to be completed is the preparation of the district annual budget, and that is an ongoing process with the management team and will be presented to us by the end of the year for our approval for the 2019 budget cycle.
Thank you. Mr. McKenna?
So under responsible board representation for our public, this is just a notification of the variety of meetings that we as commissioners attend, both state, regionally, and nationally. We track our attendance at those meetings. The only area that we struggled a little bit because of a conflict of schedules was our Energy Northwest meeting, and so that'll be something that we'll be looking at it, continuing to improve.
Yep, and it's my primary responsibility to attend those meeting at the end of July. Conflicts with granddaughter having the opportunity to skate, figure skate in Anaheim, and we searched high and low for representation, and it's just one of those moments where commissioner schedules were just blocked. So apologize for not being able to attend that meeting. Insurance compliance, Commissioner Smith?
Yes, the insuring compliance is primarily a function of two of our commission members, normally the president, vice president, being members of the internal audit committee, and we have a pretty good track record of 100% attendance at those, and when one commission member cannot, we have an alternate of the secretary to attend, and those meetings are held periodically, usually quarterly throughout the year with one or two additional meetings, and then there's a annual report back from the audit committee to the full commission, which was completed in February of this past year. So that's an ongoing function that we take very seriously.
Yeah, and when you have Eric, Stacy, and Kelly looking over your shoulder to make sure you attend those, there's just no doubt you're going to be there. So, Commissioner McKenna, evaluate governance.
So each year, the board, let me back up. The board operates under policy governance policies. And we review those on an annual basis. We review our code of ethics and our group agreements and commitments to one another, and that was completed.
Thank you. continuous improvement, excuse me, annual, you know, training and planning and budgeting, and we will do our second step of that in, is it October 4th or? 4th or 5th, review and update annual training program for newly elected board members. I guess personally I'd have to ask Mr. McKenna how that's going, but I think we're doing okay.
Lots of training.
Yes.
Mr. Bowles?
Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment. Commissioner McKenna brought up at the very beginning of this that we should probably periodically do a review like we just did for those that may be listening to this recording. And as I was listening to you on the phone, it really came through loud and clear that that's a valuable component of what we do. And so that explanation, I don't know if we need to do it every quarter, but we need to do it periodically. I think it was very valuable for us to explain to our listening public, those that listen to this recording, to remind them, just because we know what it is, they don't necessarily know. So thank you, Commissioner McKenna.
Welcome.
I have a comment, too. I would just add that I do think this is important for accountability, because we as board members are just as accountable as any other employee should be. And what happens with this is all of this gets tracked by our pretty much by our clerk, Rebecca. And so we turn in all of our information to her, and she tracks all of this. And so that's how we get this, and we set the target, and then that's how we get the actual status by Rebecca. And also, I think Deborah probably does some work on this as well. Mm-hmm. So thanks for that. I think it's important. It's important for accountability, for sure.
Okay. Any other thoughts, comments, questions that are derived from the report this morning? Hearing none. Cryptocurrency moratorium. Steve Wright.
Well, so we're back again to talk about cryptocurrency moratorium. And the question that we've been asking ourselves recently is, so what does it take to get out of the moratorium? And we've been trying to move through. We've been doing a lot of work conceptually, thinking about rates and transmission availability, distribution system availability, energy availability. We're getting to a point where we're, I think, getting closer to being able to answer the questions that would allow us to come out of the moratorium. Today we take another step in that direction by providing information regarding our thinking about rates. And I want to underscore one thing with respect to this presentation. We have been looking at cryptocurrency and thinking of it generally as being essentially lemons, that they create a lot of problems on our systems. But we've been trying to also think about how do you turn lemons into lemonade. So how do we turn this into something that can create value for our existing customer owners and at the same time potentially create an economic development opportunity and maybe bring some things here that bring value to this? So a lot of our thinking regarding the pricing in particular has been along the lines of, so what's the right price that actually accomplishes that goal? What you'll be seeing today is our best sense of a rate that it would be positive to neutral for existing customer owners. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lindsay.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, a business manager in customer utilities. At a recent meeting, we discussed the proposed cryptocurrency rate definition, and as Steve mentioned, promised to come back at this meeting with an update on other efforts underway. So that's what we're talking about today, giving you some information and, you know, if you have feedback for us, we're always happy to take that and improve our process. So, there we go. So for today's discussion, we'll provide an update on our load siting capabilities and costs. So that's the question of where could we site cryptocurrency loads to provide that benefit to the local community, and then an update on our rate considerations. Today is just a discussion. We're not looking for any decisions to be made by the board. So first off, talking about load siting capability, our transmission department has done a tremendous amount of work looking at what our system is capable of handling as far as increased loads go. And they've been looking at what we've been calling the Wenatchee Corridor. So at the last moratorium hearing, we talked about some zones, some red, green, yellow zones. So this would be considered the green zone that we're looking at here. the Old Station area, Monitor, Wenatchee, and Malaga. And through all the studies that they've performed, they've done, this is a summary of five different scenarios they've run, but really the conclusion that comes out of all the studies is that we have about 100 megawatts on our transmission system with some improvements in order to get that 100 megawatts, but about 100 megawatts if it's spread through a couple of these areas. It's less than 100 megawatts if it's just in a single point location, but at two or three of these locations, we can get about 100 megawatts out of the system, which is good news. That's capacity that's not being utilized right now and is not anticipated in the near future to be needed for local growth. So we could utilize this to bring cryptocurrency loads into the area. So as I mentioned, to add this additional 100 megawatts, there are some improvements that need to be made. And in order to accomplish those, we talk about upfront capital charges. These are is a tool that we've used with the HDL and cryptocurrency to date. So the first item here under transmission costs, this is the improvement that we would need to make to get the 100 megawatts out, and it would cost about $55 a kW for that in that Wenatchee corridor area. So our existing upfront capital charges are $190 per kW as they exist in the fees and charges schedule right now. That is something we're looking at, but this would be in addition to existing charges. Also on the transmission system, at the moratorium hearing, we talked about the red zone, which was the north or northwest of Leavenworth area along that Anderson Canyon summit line. And to date, our research and analysis continues to confirm that we would not allow connections in that area because of the cost associated with additional capacity. And then in all the other areas, or the yellow zones, as we've been calling them, we would anticipate costs in the range of $400 to $500 a kW in order to fund the necessary improvements to offset that capacity need. So those are new transmission costs in the upfront capital side of things. On the distribution side of things, we looked at the $190 per kW as compared to current cost and substation loading and things, and are anticipating that to increase to about $270. At the moratorium hearing, I mentioned it might be an additional $100, so it wasn't quite an additional $100. It was additional $80 up to $270. But also, depending on substation capacity, that could increase to $388 if it's an area where we're seeing significant congestion in our substation and infrastructure. Also, if there's substation capacity not available, the customer may be required to build or fund the necessary infrastructure to get that capacity in place. Of course, every time we talk about upfront capital charges, we have to mention that willingness to pay this does not guarantee service availability. It really depends on what our system is capable of handling. And in terms of what our system's capable of handling, we've taken a look at our substation availability. So in that Wenatchee corridor area, again, we do have a few substations that have some capacity that's not forecasted to be utilized in the next 5 years. So the size of the dots on this map indicate the relative capacity available in those areas. The green are currently available, and the one there in blue we're forecasting to be available in around 2020. When we look at these dots, we have no single location that has more than 4 megawatts available, which is what we expected. We are, as we've discussed with the board, having a lot of substation capacity challenges recently and having to build new stations and increase those capacity areas. When we look at a single substation, the capacity that's available there does not equate to a single premise or premise location, so not a single building. There's typically several feeders that come out of a substation, so there may be some capacity on a couple of those feeders, and it's not available all at the one feeder. But those would all require individual engineering studies to see how much capacity is available at an individual place. Yes, Dennis.
Lindsay, so let's just pick any one of these substations and decide that or decision is confirmed that there's 4 megawatts available. So if I'm the customer, I'm going to ask the question, how soon? So is there kind of some thoughts or rule of thumb or predictability in terms of if I wanted service yesterday, when's it really going to show up?
How long does it take?
Yeah.
So once the moratorium is lifted, we would begin processing or resume processing the applications that we currently have and take new applications. Those all go through engineering studies, and it really depends on the volume. So if we have a lot of applications in, it may take longer to get through them. Fewer applications, we can move them through quicker. Okay. Larger applications take longer. They take more significant studies. Sometimes they're working with transmission on congestion there. So
related to that question then, should we open this up, make it available? First come, first serve for those who are in line? Or what's the thought on the process of processing who gets first?
We are continuing to discuss that.
Okay.
We hope to have some information for you at the hearing.
All right. Thank you.
And Lindsay, that would include how much? Who gets first and how much? How you break down the amount that's requested, KW.
Yeah.
And sort of a follow-up question.
Yeah, Randy.
What Ann just said on the quote, how much, will we either at this meeting or our next meeting have a real number for a 4-megawatt request? What's the upfront cost going to be?
So you're not looking for that answer now, but you're looking for feedback related to it. Is that correct?
Right. I think the real world number will be of great value for us to understand, for me to understand.
Yeah.
So, Commissioner, I just say I think we're pretty close to that with this presentation. So the real world number would be the somewhere between $270 to $388 a kW, which is $270,000 to $388,000 a megawatt. Plus the $55 kW for transmission, and the difference between the 270 and 388 is based on location. So that's something that you bring us in, you tell us where you want to be, and then we can figure out where we are in that range inside of there. So I think at this point, if you were someone who was interested in coming in this area, you're getting pretty close to seeing the numbers that would be applicable to your situation. Does that help?
Yes.
And just so you know where at least one commissioner is coming from on kind of the first come, first serve, we've had some people impatient with us and not necessarily kind, and we've had people who are patient with us and have been very kind. And I think we need to be involved in recognizing that in terms of who gets served and when. Just one 20% opinion.
Thank you.
So we have a lot more work to do on that. So we'll be getting back to you.
Yeah.
Good. So that's talking about capacity and upfront charges. That's all on the infrastructure side of things. The other cost component that we talk about is the rate, the ongoing rate the customer would pay. And one of the challenges that we face, as Steve mentioned, with turning lemons into lemonade, is how to address the variability of the market. So the graph that you see here is in dollars per megawatt hour, and this is a monthly average variability on the index pricing, which we would be facing with adding additional load. And for example, today and this weekend, power has been trading at over or nearly $200 a megawatt hour, so even higher than is shown on this graph. And how do we address that variability when we're trying to keep our existing customers neutral to positive in this project? So evaluating market index pricing, if we were to put the index pricing on the customer, approximately half of the rate would be subject to the market variability, which customers could mitigate through third-party agreements. Banks and things will do swaps, a fixed for floating swap. So that's what we're talking about right now in that area. And what that turns out to look like from a rate perspective, if we use for, say, a load over a megawatt at the historic monthly average index, so that's kind of what you're looking at here is from 2006 to current. So this would be the historic and looking at kind of the last 2 years in this graph. That equals about 5.5 cents a kilowatt hour for the energy delivery and the customer charges all in there. So not the upfront charge, but all the rate components on average. If we look at what we're thinking our potential five-year future market might look like, that could be around 6 cents a kilowatt hour. And that's for commercial industrial services. So that's the analysis that we did with the high-density load rate the last time around. And one thing that's different this time around with the cryptocurrency is that we do have the residential services. We did not have those the last time we talked about rates for these high-density type loads. So for this time, this process, we are looking at what residential rates might look like because they have a different delivery system, and they're not the average commercial industrial, which was the assumption we made last time around. In those residential areas, we're looking at about 7 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour because of the increased delivery cost there. And for all these rate classes, we are also looking at excess use charges. That's one of the challenges we've been facing to date, is how to handle usage that is over what was applied for. So excess use charges would apply going forward.
Lindsay?
Yeah, go ahead, Randy.
The residential services sort of really caught my attention when I saw this chart, and I guess I was under a belief or an assumption that high density load would not be permitted generally in residential areas. What type of safeguards do we have? A safeguard system that will be put into place for residential type loads of this nature?
When we do our engineering analysis, we consider the impact on our system in those residential areas, and we do have existing services in residential areas. I know the city and some of the cities have moratoriums on residential cryptocurrency mining, but I'm looking to Eric here on the legal side of things. I don't know that we could restrict it without some specific infrastructure impacts that specific load might have in a residential area.
Yeah, so Commissioner, this is Eric. The municipalities have the legal authority to do the zoning and land use. The district doesn't. The district's real interest here is to ensure that if there is that kind of activity going on in a residential area, that all of the costs and impacts on the system, our system, are mitigated, and that's the reason for the increase to the delivery charge in those residential areas. The systems in those areas simply aren't designed to handle that kind of load. But in addition to that, as part of the application process for those kinds of loads and those kinds of areas, there would have to be a system analysis and impact study conducted, just as as is required in the commercial industrial areas, and whatever infrastructure improvements and system improvements need to be made at the point of service specific would still be required in addition to the rate.
On the other hand, while we don't have much authority there, what we are finding is that there are increased costs associated with serving these loads in residential areas, and that if you step back and take a societal perspective, it makes sense to try to drive them into places where they can be consolidated in their operations, and that's what creates least cost overall. And so what we're really doing is getting our pricing to follow what the real costs are on our system, and in doing that, encouraging the consolidation of these loads into areas that make more sense. And combine that with what you've seen in the transmission and distribution analysis, identifying the locations on our system that make the most sense as well.
Would labor and industry get involved in terms of evaluating the safety of a particular system? I think about existing residences wanting to adapt, and what type of load this is so different than traditional residential. Will it change building codes, per se?
So I don't know, Commissioner, that it would change building codes. It could have some application process changes and approvals at either the municipal level or even the PUD application process. Certainly, LNI's jurisdiction is past the meter, so we would always encourage any property owner, residential, commercial, industrial, or otherwise, to ensure that they've got all of their appropriate electrical permits, and they've got an electrical contractor reviewing the safety, and that LNI has signed off and approved. We are evaluating internally whether or not that would be something we would require. Likely it would be that we would see that there would be an LNI approval past the meter before we would reestablish service. As an example, right now where we find unauthorized loads and we discontinue service at those locations, one of the conditions that we set internally on reestablishing service at those locations is that we see Labor and Industries approval of the work that's been done past the meter by way of inspection and permit. So I don't know that that would change. I don't know that it's a decision that has been made in stone yet here exactly what that process would look like. But certainly whether it's something that is required or not, it was something that we always encourage, always have, and would continue to do to make sure that they're all the work is safely and well done past the meter.
Yeah, and this is a new zone even for LNI because we haven't had this type of load in the past.
Probably correct. Commissioner Congdon.
So I guess this would be directed to Eric, I think. So what sticks with me throughout this whole cryptocurrency discussion, I mean, starting right at the beginning, was that we need to treat similar loads equitably. And so I guess my question is for residential services, are we on solid ground here, potentially charging more? Would the energy charge be the same, but then we would just charge an additional amount for delivery? And so we're on solid ground doing this.
Yeah, so Commissioner, that's right. The energy charge was contemplated to be the same. It's really the delivery cost, right? So the residential system is simply not constructed to handle the load like this. It peaks, for half an hour in the morning and a little bit of time at night, and
yeah,
the rest of the time people
that.
Are working. So
yeah, I understand that. But is anybody else? I mean, are we breaking new ground here? Is anybody else doing this? Is anybody else charging, different rates for different locations?
So I think it's fair to say that the entire cryptocurrency space, we are all breaking new ground as we go. Mm-hmm. Having said that, no, I think that what we're doing here is just a more typical cost of service analysis. That it costs more. The difference between service in that kind of a territory versus a commercial industrial is simply the marginal difference between what it would cost if we had to go out and upgrade the entire delivery system in order to serve those types of loads in this type of space. The engineering and planning that goes into the commercial industrial infrastructure in order to serve loads that are more typical of what we see in the HDL cryptocurrency space, that work's done. It's a more robust system, and there will be implications if you start to see those loads in residential areas to the system. There will be costs at the site specific, but then there's also, we're finding increased costs and risk and impacts on the distribution system all the way back to the substation for serving in those areas. Multiple homes off of transformers. And if you're a neighbor, we're going to have to increase those transformers, potentially the cabling conductor size, in order to keep you in power and your neighbors in power when your other neighbor is mining.
Okay. So if you're really comfortable with that, then I am.
Good.
Yeah, this is standard rate-making methodology, but in the methodology, you apply it to unique situations. And one of the things we did in order to simplify this presentation for the public was just give a standard 5.5-cent rate. But behind that, there is an energy charge, a distribution charge, a transmission charge, which can be unique depending on your circumstance and where you're located.
But energy charge is the same.
Energy charge would be throughout. Market rate. Mm-hmm. We've thought about a little bit of difference between a small load as to whether when we calculate that rate, is it on a monthly basis, a daily basis, et cetera, versus a larger load. Some might have some optionality around that. But fundamentally, yes, it's we made the choice that for a cryptocurrency rate, we're going to go down the path of charging a market rate as opposed to cost of service based on our existing resource base. And whether you're residential, commercial, industrial, mm-hmm. you're all into all right. that market.
I feel better about that. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Commissioners, any other thoughts or questions? Lindsay, thanks for taking the time to work through this. Please continue.
Great feedback to bring back to the team as well. So as far as kind of a summary of what we found to date and the direction that we're headed, we're continuing the goal of keeping the non-cryptocurrency customers neutral to the impacts. We have identified those system capacity areas where we have some cryptocurrency growth potential, but costs will increase significantly once that capacity is spoken for, because that's when we do have to start expanding our system again. And to avoid the impact on local growth, we have included 5 years of forecasted load in determining what's available. That's about how much time it takes to construct a substation, sometimes longer, depending on location, but that would give us time to plan ahead and get capacity back in place where needed. And as we just discussed, we do recommend considering rate increases to reflect that cost of purchasing market energy, as well as the increased cost of delivery in residential areas.
May I
please,
comment? One more comment. How can you possibly forecast load in this arena, in the cryptocurrency arena? It's really important. That was one of my questions. You know, make sure we have a handle on what the projected load is, and then how we're, you know, make sure we reserve enough, you know, power for our organic customers. So how can you possibly do that?
In forecasting load growth, we do look at what our historical growth has been and take into consideration the other things that we know about. If we know about hotels or new services, I think at the last board meeting, Andy Wendell went through a list of the various things that we know about growth-wise coming on, and those are all taken into account in our forecast.
But what about the cryptocurrency load growth?
So we find it very difficult. All
over the, yeah. Yeah. So are we just taking somewhat of an average over the last 2 years?
We, in our load growth, we take a look at what we know about. So we've had so much requested load in the cryptocurrency mm-hmm. area that it's really dependent less on how much wants to come here and more dependent on how much we can accommodate in the time frame that we have. So
let me take that a step further and say, I think the question on a load forecast is, what will you use the load forecast for? For what purpose does it serve? And actually, it's a really important purpose, because you're trying to estimate what your infrastructure investments are going to be, what your purchases are going to be need to be in order to be able to serve those loads, et cetera. And in general, utilities take risk associated with their load forecast. You set the forecast, then you plan to that, or you mm-hmm. start to take actions to implement what's necessary based on load forecast, and to the extent you're wrong, then you've got to catch up or you've overinvested. In this case, because of the way that we're doing the pricing, we're removing the risk of the load forecast. And this is one of the most critical things, because we don't know how to forecast cryptocurrency loads very well. Yes, we have a forecast. We do have one, and it's embedded in what we use. But fundamentally, it's how we then translate that into the actions that we will take. So once we go to the cryptocurrency loads, we'll pay upfront for infrastructure investment, then the forecast doesn't matter so much anymore. Once we go to, we're going to make market purchases based on how much load actually comes onto our system, again, the load forecast doesn't, that portion of the load forecast doesn't matter to us so much anymore.
I guess.
So we've changed the importance of the load forecast to us by the way we're going about our pricing.
Yeah, and especially if we make sure we get our own organic load growth pretty much nailed down, then we're protecting our customers.
Right. And what we did is we took our organic load growth forecast and created a bit of a cushion in that too, to make sure that there would be room.
Yeah.
At least through a 5-year period, to be able to make sure that we can serve organic load growth, both whether it's from the energy component or whether it's from the infrastructure investment component, transmission, distribution, et cetera, that we've got room in order to be able to deal with that.
Okay, that's great.
So I was going to
go ahead, Randy.
I was going to offer up on Ann's question two proven methods of forecasting. One is my crystal ball, and the other one is my Ouija board.
So. Yeah, when Richard Riazzi left, he gave me one of those magic eights, so I rely on that primarily. Question I have is on market pricing. That pertains specifically to crypto, not to our current residential service.
Right. Correct. This is only an application to the new cryptocurrency rate. In fact, we're not using it for the HDL rate either.
Okay. That's our own power, not purchased on the open market.
For the high density the load HDL. Rate, yes. Now, okay. Of course, there's always the balancing. There's no system that actually you can rely on one or the other completely. But in general, and the for purposes of pricing, yes, we're assuming that we're using basically piece of the rock for all existing customers and HDL customers and market for cryptocurrency customers.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
I know we're not making a decision here today, but I really like the direction this is going. It answers many of my questions and concerns, and the people that I talk to, people are all over the place, but I think this is balanced, it's rational, it's moving forward, and I just appreciate staff's work on that.
Thank you. I'll pass that along to the team. Mm-hmm.
And I particularly appreciate the view of protecting our existing customers in this process you're going through appears to really identify how we can do that.
Okay. Okay. Next steps?
Yep. So the next steps on this are the moratorium public hearing, which is coming up on August 6th, which I believe, August is the next meeting of the board. It's at 1 p.m. at the CTC again, same location as last time. I believe the same room even. We'll confirm. Maybe not. Rebecca's given me the We'll post that. That'll be.
Oh, I did see the eyebrows go up.
Yeah. It'll be a bigger room.
A bigger room.
So is that, Rebecca, is that morning study session here and then move to the CTC again?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And just for clarification, Gary Arsenault will chair that meeting. Okay. I've waited 6 months for a cataract, and I'm not waiting six more.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lindsay.
Lindsay, thanks. Appreciate that. And again, good work on the part of staff. Appreciate it. And also to our potential customers, it's been a patient process. Thanks for hanging with us. We're trying to get it right.
This might be an appropriate moment to ask for public comment if anyone wants to on the
group. I note that we have two people, at least from the public, Nick Martini and Malachi Salcido. But either of you gentlemen care to address the commission or anyone else who? All right. Thank you, Nick. Malachi? Thank you. All right. Thanks, gentlemen. Rate setting.
Okay. So related issue. We've been given some thought to the rate setting procedures that are embedded in policy here, in part because we've been through a couple of exercises recently where it seemed like we were doing some things that certainly were well-intended at the time the policies were put in place, but seemed rather inefficient and not really achieving the objective of trying to make sure the public has the right to engage in where they want to. So we're going to make some suggestions today with respect to potential changes to those procedures, no action requested. We just want to put it in front of you and get your thoughts about how we can do this in a hopefully efficient way, but also accomplish the objective of allowing the public to be fully engaged when it wants to be.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kathy Melton, Customer Service Program Analyst. And as Steve mentioned, we're here to talk about our rate setting procedures. No action today. But did want to discuss with you some of the challenges that we have with the existing procedures and some improvement opportunities that we have identified over the
I'm just looking at the first one. No flexibility, language lacks clarity. It's like, okay, let's get started.
We're hitting it hard, aren't we? So our current procedures were adopted through a resolution established in 1980. And in that, it prescribes the number and location of information meetings that are required. Course, including a hearing as well. Along with that, it also indicates some advertising requirements and the dates in which those advertisements need to be placed in a number of sources, including local media, such as newspapers. And then also goes on to indicate the number of notices that we need to send out after an adoption of a rate to those affected customers. So, of course, as Commissioner Bowles had pointed out, we're going to jump into some of the challenges that we have with that. And one of those is that the language is very set. The locations of those meetings is set. The language around the advertising requirements is confusing, I'll put it. That's the easiest way to look at it. Often when I describe to staff what the expectation is on advertising, it's followed up with, very quickly with a come again question. So it'd be best to set that very clear now. We've also seen that at times requiring a set number of information meetings can also be not exactly the best use of our district resources and our staff time. Also can present situations that are not the most convenient for our customers to be able to make public comment on those proposals as well. And we'd also like now to incorporate some of our digital platforms that have proven to be very effective with communicating with our customers as well. So some examples that I would like to share with you where we have had lessons learned of where we would like to refine our procedures. The LED streetlights, you might remember Andrew Gassell bringing those to you. That was an overall rate reduction. The initial wave of those rate adjustments were going to include our local municipalities for a project that was going to convert from high-pressure sodium to LED fixtures. So the number of actual customers affected by this was extremely small. But because of our procedures, we were required to have three information meetings in Leavenworth, Wenatchee, and Chelan. We had nobody show up. Poor Andrew sat there with no one showing up for those meetings. So again, an example of where he'd already had that one-on-one communication with the affected parties, but we were required to have those information meetings. So probably not the best use of our district resources. Next example we have was the efforts we went through late 2015, early 2016. We had our information meetings discussing the proposal of Rate 35. Excellent meetings, and we had very good attendance at those meetings. Often we had a very the similar group that would show up to each one of our meetings. But again, if you didn't attend all of them, there was situations where customers didn't hear the input that we heard or the messages that we heard from other customers. So there's a little bit of information lost in between there. Also, again, we had them, these customers going all throughout our county where it may have proven to be more convenient for them and more consistent as far as our communication to have those meetings selected in maybe one location rather than spread out throughout the county. Another thing that we also learned throughout that because of the advertising requirements, we were not able to add in extra meetings in there if we had decided that that was necessary without having to also follow those strict advertising guidelines as well. That would have delayed the process. And then a few examples that we've had where we have come to you prior to making a recommendation for a rate proposal and asked for an exception to be made to our procedures is when we had to put in some new rates for some water and wastewater services. These were in response to an individual customer request. We had no one else that was affected by it. But again, it kind of comes back to, I guess in a way, my own personal rule with this as well. If you're continually coming back and making requests for an exception to be made to the procedure, how about we just fix the procedure and make those expectations very clear to our customers and also to staff? So what we would be looking at is to establish that clear baseline as far as our procedures moving forward. We would have our information meetings designed and tailored based on the number of affected customers, and of course the relative impact of any of those rate proposals as well. We would of course always continue to have one minimum formal hearing that would be held during a regularly scheduled board meeting. And then public notice would be using those digital platforms that we had mentioned, but of course continuing to follow with a legal notice. This would allow for more extensive opportunities for engagement with our public, but it would also give us an opportunity to follow some of the practices that we've utilized in the past, where we bring that outreach plan to you, get some feedback from you as well before we seek any action moving forward to make sure that we've hit all of the areas that you think are important to your constituents. And then taking that one step forward after a rate has been adopted, we would clean up that language as well and to indicate that we would be sending out one clear and concise notice to the affected parties within 30 days of adoption of that rate. Of course, this would also give us an opportunity to determine that additional courtesy notices may be warranted if there is a significant amount of time between adoption and implementation. plan. So as we've touched on, revised procedures just would set those clear expectations, would allow for us to tailor each one of those plans so that we can make sure that we're reaching our customers appropriately. Also improve the use of district resources, make it more convenient for our customers to have an opportunity to provide us their comments on any of those rate proposals, and eliminate some of those redundant notices that are going out that could just lead to confusion. Okay, so our next steps, of course, barring any questions that you may have, the plan is to return in August with a resolution, and that would be amending those procedures as stated in the 1980 resolution. Any questions?
Commissioners, comments, questions? Randy?
Yes, not so much a question as a couple of comments. The explanation that's been provided has been very clear, and I really appreciate it. We're today in an era that is just about 40 years removed from the last time we looked at this policy. And it seems to me that looking at the policy is long overdue. And I appreciate staff bringing it forward at this time. I'm thinking that any policy that we put in place to guarantee that our customer has the maximum opportunity in today's era, which is the digital era, to have input is really a good direction. The one thing I keep coming back to in my mind is whatever we do, making sure that we in no way ever diminish the customer's ability to have that input. And our current policy probably does that. And so the time for revision, I'm excited to see what you bring forward to it, because I think we can do better for our customer owners. We really can. So thanks for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
Other thoughts, comments, questions? Kathy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate staff's effort. Rock Island Powerhouse 2 Rehabilitation Project Procurement Method Update.
So just remember that earlier we've provided you economic analysis that shows that moving ahead with the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation is cost effective for our customer owners. We've been off thinking about how we would go about implementing this. So this is a project that mostly is in the 2020s, but it takes a lot of planning to get started, and John Sagasser will be presenting today.
Thank you. Again, I'm John Sagerser. I'm the engineering manager down at Rock Island, also the project manager for the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 Unit Rehabilitation Project. Just wanted to give you guys an update to kind of what we've been working on for the last couple of months, as well as where we're planning on going with this particular project. This is an update, so no board action is required today. As you may remember, we last met in May of 2018, and at that point in time, we were talking about increased collaboration with the hydro turbine and generator manufacturers. So in order to increase that collaboration, we issued a request for information, asking feedback on our technical specifications, asking feedback on our scope, our schedule. Were we on track? Did they have unique comments or suggestions for us as far as the project and how we'd laid it out? We also planned on evaluating some of the alternative procurement methods that are available to us through RCW 3910, which includes the general contractor construction manager method, which is currently being utilized by our strategic facilities project, and then also the design build methodology. So we did attend a workshop to evaluate the GCCM method. Was very pleased that we had three of the hydro turbine manufacturers also in attendance at that workshop. So they were serious about investigating these alternative methods as well, and whether they would be valuable for them as well as for the district. We had the district's Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation team was in attendance at that. We learned quite a bit about the GCCM process. We also learned quite a bit about the design build process while we were there, because they're very similar. What we did learn, though, is that GCCM is not really a valid method for our particular project, the Powerhouse 2 project, mainly because the law has limits on how much work can be self-performed by the prime contractor. So depending on the type of work that it is, it's anywhere between 30% of the contract and 50% of the contract. Whereas in the unit rehabilitation work, we're, you know, up in the 90%. Our prime contractor is our designer, they're our builder, they're our manufacturer. They do most of the work themselves. And so those limits just typically won't work for our project. There are a couple of other reasons that that we found it probably wouldn't work, but that was probably the main one. We also got responses. We got very good responses from the three main turbine generator manufacturers to our request for information. We got comments on our technical specifications. One of the consistent feedback that we received from all three vendors was if we were serious about improving our generator, because we have some known concerns with the cooling of the generators. We have some known access problems with our generator. And if we're serious about addressing those issues, then we're going to need to replace the stator and the rotor on all 8 units. This is different than what we brought to you in May. In May, our thoughts regarding the scope of work were that we would build one new stator, which was mainly for schedule impact, so we could take a generator out, put the new generator in, and then while we rewind that generator, the unit's not out of service. It allows us to expedite the schedule of the rehabilitation. So this is a little bit different. So what it means to us is we've got some additional evaluation to do. We either need to evaluate our criteria. Do we really want to address these cooling issues and these access issues? And if so, then we need to evaluate the economic impact of the particular project, because it's going to affect us either way. We need to change our criteria, or we need to anticipate higher costs. So we're evaluating that right now. We also hired a consultant, a company called Parametrics, to help us evaluate these alternative procurement methods and whether they might be suitable for our project. So we met with our consultant in early July to evaluate what might be the best method, whether it we already kind of determined that GCCM wasn't going to work, so we were looking at the design build methodology, as well as the traditional, which is what we're used to, where we develop a scope, put it out to bid. We agreed during that meeting that something called the progressive design build method was well suited for our particular project. Under the design build method, what you do is you develop a request for qualifications that kind of describes what you're looking for in partner for your project. So qualifications can include anything. For us, it would include, you know, their safety record, their manufacturing capabilities, their design capabilities related to bolt turbines. Could include their financial standing, their ability to bond, information along those lines. But you issue this request for qualification. Then you receive responses to those requests, you evaluate them, and then you select a short list of contractors, as many as you want, anywhere from 1 to 3, in our case, based on their qualifications to perform the work. Then you enter into a design phase where you have that short list of contractors do some level of design. It can be anywhere from, you know, 5% design to 100% design. In our case, we think somewhere in the 30% range is probably appropriate. But you have them each progress a design and respond to your request for proposal, which would include their unique design solution for your particular project, as well as some cost factors of how much they think it's going to cost to build their solution. Then you evaluate that based on the design, and then you negotiate, you select one at that point in time, then negotiate the contract, the technical specifications, the scope of work, et cetera, based on their unique design solution. And then you're off and running, which would be more typical of a project from that time forward. So the design build method, though, is it changes a lot of things. It's a quite a bit of different methodology than what we're used to. Not only does it change the selection process, how you select a contractor, but it also changes a lot of the questions that you ask them. So instead of saying, here's the scope of work with the schedule, tell us how much it's going to cost, and getting, you know, 3, 4, 5 prices for the exact same scope of work, you step back and you're saying, here's our problem, here's what we're wanting to accomplish, give us a solution on how to fix it. And so as many contractors that you have, you're going to have that many unique responses back. Different scopes, different schedules, different costs. And it puts the onus back on the district, on us, to evaluate that to determine which of those solutions actually provides the best for the most, for the longest.
John, I want to add something here. I think this is a really important moment for us because we're on this journey to best for the most, for the longest. And in trying to accomplish that, we're now looking at new approaches to contracting. And that's changing things around here. And it's causing us to actually do things differently. One of the things that John's reporting on here is, so now we're working more closely with the vendors, and they're saying, boy, if you want that kind of design life, the refurbish option for the generators may not be your best one. It may be a replacement option. So that has some additional cost associated with it. That makes me gulp. I will admit. You know, you just have, then you have to go back and say, okay, but the deal is, this is what we're shooting for. Our economic analysis assumed a certain design life, and we need to know what it takes to be able to accomplish that, and then measure that against the benefits and determine whether this is the right thing to do or not. So the good news is the benefits part of this equation is relatively robust, and a very quick look at what those additional costs would be relative to what we've shown you in the past in our economic analysis would not cause us to turn away from this project. Still pretty robust, and so it seems to look good. Our commitment to you, though, is that we're going to be evaluating that cost effectiveness every step along the way. So we'll see how this plays out over the next few months as we continue to engage in the process that John has described, where we're going to have potentially a couple of consultants in here in the early stages, and we're going to be learning from them and figuring things out about how do you actually achieve that design life, what's the real cost in order to be able to get there. So the part that I feel good about is we're really diving in a lot more deeply about making sure that we understand what it's going to take to achieve that design life, to achieve what's up on the wall there.
So how does this impact our schedule? So on the left, we have kind of the original schedule that we presented to you back in November of 2017 when we presented the scope of the project as well. And on the right, we have how a progressive design build method would change that schedule. I'd like to point out real quick that as you can see down at the bottom, it doesn't really, at this point in time, we don't anticipate a change to the first unit outage start date or the completion of the last unit outage. What it does mean is prior to that, we've got quite a bit of time in there up front. We need to present an application to the state, getting their authorization to use this design build method. It would require a trip back to the board to request authorization to advertise, the request qualification, and then a series of the RFQ response, shortlisting our contractors, and then negotiation and award in early to mid 2019, the contract. So, what are our next steps? Barring any objections, our next step would be to redesign the economic model to evaluate the design build proposals. We're going to get a whole bunch of different solutions, some recommending new components, some refurbishing components, and we're going to be able to evaluate those side by side and create an apples-to-apples comparison from all of these unique solutions. We need to complete our state application. That is due August 20th. We also need to finalize our request for qualification documents. What qualifications are we going to ask for, and how are we going to evaluate which vendors are qualified and which ones are not, or which ones we want to shortlist. We'll present to the State Project Review Committee in late September, which would bring us back to the board requesting authorization to advertise our request for qualification at the board meeting. October 1st is our target date. We'd expect to advertise the RFQ by October 31st, no later than October 31st, and as well as draft the request for proposal, that the design process phase and what we would use to select a contractor following that. Questions?
Steve. So what's the benefit or the consequence or risk? What's the difference for the contractor or the partner here is in, so we put out a question or a challenge to them, they put their thinking into it versus just here's your RFP, bid it out. Mm-hmm. What's the difference for them?
So the main concern that I've heard from them over and over again is their loss of intellectual property. So one of their greatest concern is through this process, as we collaborate with them, as they come up with these unique ideas, these unique solutions that set them apart from the competition, that's either going to get lost and given to their competition, or it's going to be put into more of a traditional design bid build package where all of a sudden now everybody has to implement their idea. And so that's one of the risks. What the design build does, though, is it allows them to develop that unique, innovative solution, but it stays with them. So they have a one-on-one relationship with this. Even though it's more of a public design process, we can allow them to share those unique ideas and develop them for a mutual benefit, as well as, you know, contractor B, so to speak. They can, it kind of protects that intellectual property. The risk, which is maybe a little bit higher in this one, is, you know, like any other traditional design bid build, they're going to spend money to go after that work. In this case, they're going to potentially spend a little bit more going through that design process than they would in a traditional design bid build. And state law anticipates that and actually requires us to pay what's called an honorarium to the contractors that we don't select. And so it can be any amount that we set, but we do have to pay and offset some of those expenses for, that they would incur for the design process.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation Transmission. I just wanted to add to that point that John made is a really good one, that there's the contractor involvement early on. And I think just to reinforce the point Steve made earlier, what's in it for them in this process is they get an opportunity to be involved with the owner earlier and really understand what our objectives are, more so than the traditional process where you pretty much spec out the equipment and say, yep, this is what we want. We want a five-year warranty. Provide that to us. They now, and you can see just what John walked through, is they now got some information they've shared. Well, we're here and you really want longevity here. And as a result of that, they're involved in us with us early on saying, we think you might want to consider replacement rather than refurbishment if you really want a long-lived asset. And so just as we want to meet our objectives, the contractors want to as well. They don't want to be part of a project that delivers, yeah, exactly what we asked for. Mm-hmm. In the traditional process where we asked for a five-year warranty, it lasted 5 years or 6 years, and then we have a problem with it. They don't want to be part of that either. They want to be part of us meeting our objectives. So they do have a lot of interest in being along the way. And it really, for us, the other benefit was for them, but also for us, is we get to use all the collective wisdom and knowledge in the hydro industry, not just from the owner standpoint, but from the manufacturer, designer, and builder standpoint as well.
Yeah, I want to reinforce that point. I think what we're seeing is a bit of unleashing of creativity within the vendor community, because they have felt constrained by least cost bidding. Right. Now we're saying, no, wait a second, that life cycle cost is what really matters to us. Mm-hmm. That creates some excitement for them too.
But does our response to them, to their concern about losing intellectual property, are they for the most part satisfied with our response to how that will be somewhat protected?
I believe so. They like the again, the design build in a traditional one. We're required, everybody has to bid the same thing. So any mm-hmm. of that intellectual property that would come through, say, the request for information process, would have to be wrapped up into a specification and given out in the public process. Under the design build methodology, we don't have to do that. And so that protects them and protects their unique ideas and their unique solutions.
So why their concern then?
I think we were addressing it in the design build process.
Oh, okay. All right.
But we're trying something new.
Yeah.
So we're still in a phase of learning. Yeah. We're both learning from each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're working through their concerns. They're working through ours.
Okay. They have used the design build method before, at least on a smaller scale. This is something that Seattle City Light has recently done at Boundary Dam for mm-hmm. some generator rewind mm-hmm. projects, and they were able to use it successfully. The feedback that we got from all the manufacturers at that point in time was they liked the process. Even the ones who didn't win the project liked the process. They felt that they were protected, that it was fair. It gave them that opportunity to be creative, and actually felt like they put quite a bit more into the process than they would if they were just responding to a right. traditional bid.
That's what I was curious about. That if there's an honorarium involved there, at least they can offset, you know, they can take a little bit better risk of investing even if they don't get it. So
yeah, they're getting some of their expenses back. And yeah. a traditional bid, no, it's lost. Whatever they put into that bid is a sunk cost. At least in this process, they get a portion of it back. But also, again, the idea for them to be able to come up with an innovative solution, something that sets them apart without having to give that away to their competition,
yeah.
is exciting to them. I mean, that's why they're in business a lot of times, is because of that innovative competition, to be able to set them apart unique from everybody else and have that unique solution.
This is pretty exciting. I mean, this is definitely breaking new ground for us and for them, huh?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, wow. Kudos to you guys for stepping out of the box and stepping up, really. That's cool.
It kind of follows suit with this morning's letter from Gene Sherritt, just in terms of the innovative and willing to take a look at something different and do it differently with the hope of a different result. And appreciate it very much. Nice bowl.
Yeah, I like that.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. John.
Thank you.
Okay, so next up is an item that the board, I think, is very familiar with, but we haven't had a discussion in public session about, which is the port PUD tentative agreement term sheet for facilities and land acquisition. So Dan Frazier is going to walk through a presentation for you today.
Morning, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, the Director of Shared Services. Again, this is another informational-only presentation. No action is requested or required today. We'll be taking you through a few items, the proposed property agreement, as Steve referred to, the term sheet, the public comment proposed outreach that we're putting around that term sheet itself, just the specific deal. The reasons for the proposed consolidation, that's something that we've been talking about in this forum for quite a while, but it's always good to remind us why we are doing these things, so we'll kind of go through that quickly. Our plans for public engagement regarding an operations and service center headquarters, proposed improvements out there, and what we would bring to the public in terms of ideas, helping get their feedback. And then the discussions surrounding the redevelopment of this facility and other facilities like the Holly Street facility, were we to decide to move forward. So the major elements of the agreement, the PUD has been negotiating with the port for some time on the three parcels in the Old Station area, commonly referred to as the Haran Block, totaling 19 acres. So we would purchase those from the port district. The port would then purchase our two condominium units in the CTC, which is the lower level one and the unit 201, totaling just under 20,000 square feet. We would lease back those facilities for a period of time that it would take to build our new facility, but that would be a four-year initial term with 2 one-year extensions. We would also lease a 25% stake in the video conference center, and this was something that will allow us to develop a new facility without spending additional funds on a large auditorium. If there's an availability just a few hundred feet away for a large meeting space, we can take advantage of the CTC, and it also helps the port fill that space more often and gives them the ability to keep that facility open. We would also, for a short term, for a four-year period, lease a portion of what's called IB5, most commonly known as the JanSport building. Most of us remember the JanSport operation there. We'd be leasing a portion of that building, and that would take care of some of our immediate space needs. We've been keeping our expansion kind of on idle for several years as we've evaluated what our long-term facility needs were. And so there's been some pent-up demand. There's also some other projects going on that need space, so we'd be able to use that space. We would also use it to actually develop the site. If we were to relocate out there, it's right across the street from the site. It'd be a great project office for us without leasing trailers to come in on the site. Actually, this next piece was related to something we discussed earlier today, the high-density load. What we would do is provide an exemption to those upfront charges that were discussed, and that would be for an existing space or existing use in the facility. And this was to assure the port that if they did have a turnover in their tenancy with their high-density load, their existing high-density load, they could bring in a new high-density load and not be subject to those upfront charges. And this would have a 10-year sunset, and then any changes after that 10 years, they'd be subject to whatever rates or charges were in existence at that point in time. Also, very instrumental in this is an agreement between the City of Wenatchee, the Port, and the PUD to look at the redevelopment efforts on this site. This is something we've heard about from both the Downtown Association, Chamber of Commerce. They're concerned that we think through a robust plan to backfill the PUD's occupancy of this site. And then the Port, and as part of that process, has requested that they have a first option to purchase should they see an opportunity on this site that would actually, both this site and Holly Street, they could step in and take on a redevelopment on either of those sites. So the properties we're talking about there, the PUD would purchase the ones outlined in red, those three properties totaling 19.05 acres. The Port Industrial Building 5, JanSport's there. That section that's highlighted in yellow would be the portion that we would be leasing. And then the green, obviously, is the CTC that we would be selling LL1 and 201 to the port. That would give them 100% ownership in the building. So we've asked the public to comment on this. I did a tour through the media last week, and we're continue to have things on our website. The press release that details in high-level terms what the agreement at this point, the term sheet contains, is online, and we've asked for the public to provide feedback there. Very limited feedback thus far on social media, and we had one direct comment after one of the presentations. But obviously, we're here today making sure this is out there in the public domain, and Commissioner Bowles and Smith and I met with the Port Board last Tuesday, went through roughly the same presentation, and they've asked for public comment from their perspective. So again, back to the why are we doing this? Why are we looking at this? This really goes back to our strategic plan from 2015, reinvesting in our core value-producing assets, including facilities. It was a top goal in that strategic plan. And so around that strategic plan goal, we created the facilities plan core goals of maximizing productivity, optimizing our service levels, producing the best financial value, providing that cost predictability, and enhancing safety, both public safety and worker safety. And through this process, we developed a strategy that meets all of those goals. And that's why the consolidation recommendation is still the best, meeting all five of those core goals. So over the next several months, we'll be working with our design team. Actually, we kicked off last week working with our design team to develop concepts for a new operations and service center and headquarters campus. So we're working right now on the things like adjacencies and massing, how big a space for each group. And this was done at a very high level about 18 months ago. So we're just validating most of that work and then really getting an understanding about adjacency. That's really important when you bring people together. We hear all the way from, if we're on the same campus, I don't care how close I am to another group, all the way to, it's really important for me and my group to be really close to this other function. And one of the things we're trying to do is get that customer-facing, customer service interface to be the best it can be. And so we've really met with all those groups that have a customer-facing portion of their operation. We're trying to see how they would fit into a one-stop shop. That's really, really important in these type of facilities, that the public knows where they're going, they go in the door, and they can get all those services. So that's kind of what we're doing right now. And from that, we'll be able to kind of mass up the building, look at how many floors for the headquarters piece. And the same thing out in the yard with the operations groups, who needs to be near what materials. We found out some things that, you know, I need to touch that transformer three times, and here's the three things I need to do with it. So, okay, you don't want that all the way across the yard. So those type of things. So from that, we'll develop some site plans and some renderings. We'll actually be able in this day and age of technology to give some really good understanding about what we're proposing and give some optionality around that look. We want the community to let us know what they think. So after we've got these kind of preliminary looks at what the facility is, we'll go in for a public involvement in this design process. Once we're ready, we'll put this out on an evaluation portal online. We'll provide renderings for the buildings. We'll provide some interactive displays. We'd like to do some fly-throughs so people can understand from different perspectives, driving into town, driving out of town. We've heard a couple different ways to look at this. One is, you're a public agency, don't build a Taj Mahal. Well, of course, we're not going to do that. But also, it's the gateway to Wenatchee, so make it look nice. It is an entryway that we want to make sure we're complementing what the city looks like and welcoming people into the city. So we'll be also hosting some public meetings to evaluate what the proposal is and getting feedback. We're also looking to provide employee feedback, what they think about the facility. So something that we started with last week is this conceptual site plan. This plops a conceived. This is kind of the massing of what the buildings would look like, or at least a 2D on that site. Obviously, if you're coming down the highway there from the lower left-hand kind of around that curve, that building is going to be very prominent. So we talked a lot about how that building will provide the tone for what the site would look at. And the buildings in the back, it's hard to read on this, but buildings C, D, E, and F would be lower buildings, more industrial type buildings, more in keeping with several of the other buildings in that area. But they would be behind and hopefully not as prominent as the building you can see coming from the west. So as I mentioned, another really important part of this is this partnership with the city and the port. We want to make sure we help whatever takes our place here to be something that's a benefit to the downtown. So we want to engage an urban redevelopment planning firm. We'll be a collaborative selection of that with the city and the port. We'll conduct an analysis, and we've done a lot of analysis of our facilities, so we'll provide them with that analysis of the buildings, their structures, their mechanical, electrical, all those type of things. And they can evaluate if there's good long-term use, other use than the PUD's use of these buildings. And then they'll do an economic analysis of what other uses are lacking downtown. And this is in collaboration with the city. The city has a downtown redevelopment plan. It was done several years ago by a company called Makers. And so they already have some ideas about what they would like to see downtown and what would complement the existing uses downtown. So we'll incorporate that into the economic analysis. We'll have our advisory committee, the business community, Wenatchee Downtown Association, Chamber of Commerce, all involved in this so that everybody has stakeholder buy-in. And then we'll develop some key strategies, things that we think are possible to do, two or three different strategies. Then from that, we will take those to the next level. And one of the ways we can make sure that happens is to seed a redevelopment revolving fund so that we can make sure that whatever we need to do to get to that next level, we can provide the opportunity to get the buildings or the site in the right condition so that the market can then take it over, whether it's private or public or nonprofit or a partnership, can take that to the next level.
So may I interrupt, Dan?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thanks. So is there, are there some boundaries around? Are there some, this redevelopment revolving fund, is there a limit in terms of, what our involvement in terms of time and dollar amount?
Well,
in that?
Definitely. We it's not structured at this point, but the intent of this is a PUD controlled fund. So we originally have batted around several different ideas on how to administer that process, and we feel like our ability to get feedback but not dilute our decision making was really important, because we want to make sure this works for us short term and long term. So we'll get the feedback, but ultimately we'll have to decide on how we as the district want to see this redevelop, and then we'll control that. The board obviously controls the expenditures of funds, and so we can set whatever timelines we want on that, limits in reinvestment.
Oh, okay. So we commit to a fund, but we're in control. We set the boundaries on that. We set the
absolutely
the goals and what we would need to do to get those reach those goals.
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's not an open-ended, open access, open-ended equation.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would add, our goal is we're investing with the intention of being able to get our money back. So it's not we're just going to throw money at this. It's mm-hmm. What does it take to try to increase the value of these assets to a purchaser?
Yeah, so that's important that we keep that in the forefront when we move into this. Mm-hmm. That's what our real goal is.
Yep. Yeah. Two things. One, the largest anxieties I'm picking up in the community is what to do with this facility. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate Absolutely. The answers on that. And then secondly, if we can go back one page, there's a line out of a movie that oftentimes troops vote with their feet. We have a lot of great employees, and one of the things you see throughout the day are people taking their breaks and their lunch hours and that sort of thing, accessing our current trail system. On this map, is there some kind of an idea where that would be and how that's being looked at?
The interface with both the river and the park is very important to this project, and we discussed it at length last week, whether that be something where it's along kind of out of the building and coming down across the tracks here. But really, we've talked about coordinating with the extension. There's a proposed extension of the loop trail up the Wenatchee River. And so providing the opportunity to get into that vicinity is a big part of this project, and we'll provide access to that.
So it would just be a stub.
At this point, it'd be a stub, but
we're not extending that to Leavenworth today. Just check.
No.
No.
It was actually part of the Confluence Parkway proposal to get across. So we don't have any plans on how to do that at this point, but the city has proposed that.
There.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I just think that's an important piece when, in consideration for the public and our employees, and appreciate the effort.
And another, along those same lines, up, if you notice the walkway between the CTC and the proposed headquarters, would take you along the, I like that the east side of the ports building is actually kind of the nicer area there. So we'd like to create a good walkway back and forth there. So it's not something that's, you know, hop a fence and jump a retaining wall type to get over there.
Good.
So you can create something that's a nice connection. And then from there, you're pretty close to other recreation.
You could kind of create a little physical barrier there for exercise, but probably
little hurdles.
Yeah.
Okay, so so at Holly Street, obviously we've got some things happening right in that area right now. We've got an expansion that we're proposing of the substation to provide loads, provide distribution for new loads coming on in that area. And we've been working with the city and Stamilt over the last couple of years, and we'll continue to do that to make sure that we're helping the city realize their long-term North Wenatchee plan. But in terms of creating the value for us in that property, too, we want to get as much as we can through the sale of that property and want to develop in a way that's complementary to what the city and Stamilt are planning down there. So that's really all I had.
Other thoughts, questions? Randy?
I've been listening intently, and he's gone through it well.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Congdon?
Nothing more. Thank you.
McKenna? Dan, thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
I might just ask if there's any public comment. Well, I can do that. Yeah. Any other, is there public comment or staff? Say, all right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
We've actually achieved our morning agenda, so I would like to move to a couple of our manager items just to make sure we use our time efficiently here. If Kirk Hudson will join us, talk about the surge tank update.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. You might recall on May 14th, Dan Garrison provided an update of Rocky Reach and Lake Chelan projects. And as part of that update, he talked about surge tank outage and a lot of surge tank work that would be happening this summer with that scheduled to come out of service and unwatering of the penstock on July 16th. It actually did come out of service on July 16th for maintenance. So surge tank is being painted on the outside and the inside. We've got a number of projects with the unwatering of penstock going on in the Chelan powerhouse, including breaker replacements, overhaul on unit A1, cavitation repair on A2, as well as replacing relays and exciters on those units. So a whole bunch of work to be done right now until last part of September, early October. Along with that, we certainly heard some concerns from some of our stakeholders in regards to, okay, if the powerhouse is out, what should I be concerned about electrical service-wise? So our staff, both customer utilities and communications and generation and transmission staff have been up in the Chelan area talking to some of our key accounts and irrigators in terms of what's gone in place in terms of preparing for that. And for the most part, I think it's gone pretty well. We provided another opportunity last week on Tuesday for additional information sharing questions, and we did not have anybody show up for that. So work's underway, and we're now making sure that gets done on time because there's work waiting to be done when this outage is complete as well. So we've got a short window here to get all that work done.
What's that date, the completion date?
So October 5th is when the last unit will come, is scheduled to come back. The end of September, we hope to have the one unit back. So penstock will be watered back up sometime in late September.
So I was at the at this last meeting where none of the public showed up, but it was great for me because I had eight PUD top level folks giving me a top level briefing. So I know everything I needed and wanted to know about the surge tank. But I think it just totally makes sense to do all this other work as long as you have the outage going on. So yeah, but thanks for the effort anyway, you guys coming up to Chelan.
It's so important. So I think probably for the recording record, we should clarify that was Wednesday, not Tuesday of last week. That meeting, right?
That's right. Thank you for the correction.
Yeah, it was Wednesday. Yeah.
Okay. Kirk, thank you.
Thank you.
Good. I want to invite Felicity Saberhagen to come up, talk about the new agreement with the Wenatchee Rowan Paddle Club.
I actually get to share some news that I think Jeff Smith would have been very excited to share, and he had worked very diligently on this permit as well as another permit with the city to pave that area. On July 5th, we did authorize the permit for the paddle club to utilize the property that is adjacent to our park at the end of 9th Street, and it's also the Still building. There are three sites that are included in that. One, the Linden Tree building, the building itself, and then an area adjacent to that, which is a 40 by 40 foot outdoor space that will be paved. The remainder of that will be paved by the city through an agreement that we entered into on April 16th. That portion will be fenced off for the Wenatchee Rowan Paddle Club. Again, this is just a reminder, too, that that area will not be able to be used for the city to meet their requirement for parking through through the city code 10.60.80.
Please do a question.
Yeah, if I may absolutely.
You. Event parking?
Event parking. This will be allowed for event parking,
all right.
But will not be allowed to meet their other requirements.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Were there any other questions on that? Thank you.
Okay. All right, thanks.
I want to invite Mike Coleman and John Stoll to come up. We had an outage last week in the city of Wenatchee that's creating some challenges for us trying to get repairs. And we have, everyone's back in service at the moment, but there are some issues right now that could be difficult for us, and I also think they're a harbinger of things to come. So it's worth just taking a moment to talk about this.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. As Steve mentioned, it was last Wednesday night, I believe, we had an outage between two switch points in our system in the downtown, generally around the 9th Street and Mission intersection. We had a vintage 1976 cable. It was in conduit, but it sustained a fault, a pretty significant fault. In fact, you know, the cable's pretty damaged, and it impacted the duct system, the conduit, to the point where they're still exploring as we speak, can they still use that conduit? Hopefully the damage isn't so bad that it's not feasible, but they're still looking into that. But again, it happened last Wednesday night. It took out about 300 customers. Most of these, of course, it's a lot of businesses. It was in the evening, I believe, around probably 8 o'clock. The clinic is one of the key accounts that happens to be impacted by that outage. Based on investments in the past, where we put in more switching points, the crews were able to switch around fairly quickly. It's a complicated effort, but they were able to look at loading on other stations, feed around where this outage was to get the customers back installed. And I think it was about an hour everyone was back in service, with the exception of two businesses that were addressed in the morning. So anyhow, that's kind of the basics of it. But again, with it, we do have some challenges, and how do we kind of take that hole in our system right now where we have the what we call our normal state, and we don't lose any redundancy in our system. So that gives you kind of a lay of the land of what we're looking at. And with that, there's some challenges. Mike will speak a little bit more on the fiber impact, but one thing we discovered back in 76 when they installed this cable and conduit system, they put in a spare duct. These are 6-inch pipes that they would put the three cables through. The decision was made to put in a pretty significant fiber line in the other one. So that complicates trying to use that duct system to run a new set of cables through. So anyhow, we're just trying to understand, can we reuse the existing one, or do we have to look at some sort of option around using that other duct system that does have a significant fiber line in it, and that would have its own impacts as well.
Okay. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. The impact on the fiber system from the initial outage was no impact. Where we come into play is we are occupying that second duct, the second 6-inch duct. The electrical conductors will not fit in that duct with the fiber cable that's in there. So if we have to utilize that duct to bring the electrical system back up to its normal state, that means we're going to have to make some changes to the way the fiber is distributed through that area. There's roughly 70 customers, business customers. There's also three dark fiber circuits that are in that particular cable. The team is looking at five options. They range from being able to reuse the existing conduit the electrical conductors are in to the other four involving a different option with potentially having to remove the fiber from the duct that it's in today and either finding a different way to route it, potentially move it over to the damaged conduit if that's possible. Depending upon which option we end up with, we're going to have a different impact to the fiber customers. That could range from a one-day outage all the way up to possibly multiple outages over multiple days in order to rehome, reconstruct the fiber system to serve those customers. So right now the team is looking at it. We don't have a crystal clear view of what the options are going to be until we get some more information from the team that's working on looking at the damaged duct. Once we have that, we have a set of decisions to go through. The key thing here is going to be communications and timing and preparation. By first of all doing the outreach to the customers, both the electrical and the fiber. Secondarily, it's a case of some really good planning and preparation work because that will minimize any outages that we do have to take from this. So it's a complex set of decisions, but the ultimate goal is to get everything back to a normal state.
Clinic part of that.
I'm sorry?
Is the clinic part of that?
The clinic is part of that.
Okay.
In multiple ways. I think one of the dark fibers is feeding the clinic, plus there's some lit services.
Okay. Thank you.
What's the damaged duct look like? Does it have holes in it? Is it collapsed?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up there. We actually brought in a company who has video equipment as well as potential tools to go into there and actually look around to see what the damage is. Thinking the duct has collapsed. There was significant heat and significant force that happened with the fault. It may have even been damaged prior to that. I don't know. But we'll get some good forensics on that. And ideally, we can repair that, make use of that duct system, and then re-pull in the cable. Right. One side
note.
How long
section is it that's damaged?
It's probably, it could be a couple of feet, just hard to tell until they get in there and look around. But it was, again, I went out there and checked it out the next morning, and the impact from the fault actually had reverberated back to the PMH switch cabinet that we have and damaged that to the point of having to be replaced. Mm. And it was fairly, it had a long life as well. On a side note, I think Chad Rissman did some analysis on this cable. Half our system, about 800 miles, is underground cable. Some of it's direct buried, some of it's in conduit like this. This was vintage 76, so a 42-year life, which is pretty good for cable. We've got about 114 miles of that vintage of cable, that what I would consider kind of the first generation of cable, underground cable system that's out there. So it speaks to what you'll see in our budgeting process, and the board's always been very supportive of looking at our cable replacement strategies and helping us put a focus on that. But, again, it's, as Steve mentioned, that's just kind of a peek in the bag into the future and some of our asset management strategies and where we see some opportunities to, keep, maintain reliability, if not improve.
Those are definitely core assets.
Yeah. Just thinking, if I was buried for 42 years, I probably wouldn't look very well either.
So I want to stay on this point for a moment because I think it raises a strategic point, underscoring John's point there. So 140 miles of cable that is roughly 40 years old with a design life of 30 years suggests we have an issue. And the challenge that we have is that we're trying to do that at the same time. Remember, a couple of years ago, we got changes in National Electric Safety Code that requires us to do a lot of work on our distribution system. And at the same time, we're trying to do fiber expansion on poles and trying to address the NESC work. So we're running into conflicts right now in terms of priorities. And this is one of the things that we're going to be talking about a lot as we get into these five-year business plans and the budgeting process for next year is we've got some challenges here in terms of trying to maintain, and I would say if we want to have the same level of reliability we have today, do better even than what we've done, mm-hmm. we're going to have to address in the coming budget process.
You know, 42 years ago, there was not even a concept of a parallel fiber and electric system.
I agree. I think the other comment I would add to that is this represents the set of issues that come in with the joint use, both joint use on poles as well as conduit, and it's now a reality that we deal with. That is certainly one of the reasons that we look at it and say that John and I have to be joined at the hip, and we always have to be focused on the best solution that we can craft and take into account that both technologies are in those spaces.
Other comments, questions? You know, thanks for bringing that forward and clarifying that. Remember when the outage notice came out thinking, that was an interesting evening. But again, congratulations to our crews for running that down, getting it back up and switching around and getting people back up and going. Just much appreciated.
Thank you.
Got one more fun one. Bev, would you please come on up? Yeah, you do. I thought we had told you that. So actually, this is a moment of celebration. You all know Bev Freeman, and you know what a fantastic job she does around here. She volunteered a couple years ago to take on the retirees luncheon. And I will tell you that having been here both before and after Bev's participation, it's getting better all the time. And it's really because of her work. So she had the foresight to go out and survey the retirees and say, what do you want? And actually then be able to deliver something that's more like what they want. So we had a huge turnout this year, lots of positive feedback. So she is our Cycle of Personal Ownership winner for this month, really climbing that ladder of accountability, saying, you know, what can I do that will make a difference around here and make things better? And we just want to take a moment and say thank you to her for all that she has done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Beth.
Thanks for your hard work.
And don't you dare leave yet. On a personal notice, you know, last year and a half plus has been pretty arduous. And I will say to the moment, Bev has always been incredibly responsive and made Joyson's life and mine much, much different. So appreciate you personally. Like the way you look at your job.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And you don't have to say anything.
Did you bake the cookies at the luncheon? I loved how many there were. You know, endless supply. Great.
We have one more manager's item, but I think I'm going to save it till after lunch.
With that being said, let's adjourn until 1 o'clock, and we will start our business meeting at that time. good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon session of Chelan County Board of Directors, July 23rd, and we're into our business session in the afternoon, and we will be looking first at our consent agenda.
Commissioner, we actually have a hearing scheduled at 1 o'clock on the IRB.
Well, what do I know?
I missed it as well because they appear so infrequently. We have a noted public hearing on the integrated resource plan. I know
we do.
We snuck it in ahead of the consent.
Yeah. With that. Well, it's just such a little tiny.
I know.
All right. We will consider that first. Public hearing, 2018 integrated resource plan. I actually read it and then got here. Thank you.
So we're here pursuant to notice to consider our, it's our two-year report this time, isn't it? For the district's integrated resource plan has been noticed pursuant to the required legal notice, and Becky Keating's here to present.
Hi, Commissioners. Becky Keating, Energy Planning and Trading. We were last here on June 4th to present you the final draft. No changes have been made to that draft. We're asking for your approval by resolution today. No public comment has been received during the entire process.
Okay. Comments, questions, statements by commissioners? Hearing none. Randy, was that just a blurb in the, or did you have a comment?
No, that was me discovering I didn't have my phone on mute, and I put it on mute.
Okay. So, do we have a motion?
We actually do. Commissioners have a resolution for consideration. It's resolution number 13 under the regular agenda. The board could take it up now if it's so inclined, or handle it as part of the later agenda.
Now let's go ahead and take it as part of the public hearing process so they're sequential.
So, Mr. Chairman, I move approval of resolution number 13 approving the district's 2018 Integrated Resource Plan Progress Report.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept resolution 13 as presented. Any further discussion or any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Now, we will go to the consent agenda. Commissioners, your desire, please.
I'd like to move approval.
Okay, it's been moved to approve the consent agenda as presented. Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as presented. Discussion? Hearing none. Motion, please. Oh, yes, we do have a motion.
We do have a motion.
We do have a motion. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.
No. Motion is carried. Now, the regular agenda.
Okay. So, item 12, a resolution ratifying field work orders number 1 and 2 and approving field work order change order number 3 to the district leaded and diesel fuel supply contract number 15-30. Dan, welcome. Lance, welcome.
We didn't plan the matching.
No.
Oh, yeah, you guys look really cute.
I know. It's like, so, Dan, what are you wearing today?
Imagine my surprise when he called me and said, I'm wearing a tie today. It's great. And then I walk in the door. I'm lucky
me
to wear
too.
The same tie.
And for all time, you're now officially cute.
Yeah.
Just bookends of cuteness, you know?
Okay.
All right. We'll stop.
Thank you. Again, Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services here.
Lance Knudsen, Fleet Supervisor.
We're here today to seek approval of a resolution, and this resolution is to ratify two previous field work order change orders for our fuel contract and to approve the third field work order change order. So some history behind this. This is our it was originally conceived as a five-year agreement, but during the process, they decided to make it a three-year agreement with 2 one-year renewals. And so we are exercising the second year of renewal and adding funding to the contract. So as most of you have seen, fuel prices have been continuing to escalate as we started this contract. It's in really good shape. We're starting to see those costs go up. And so we've estimated the July 2018 through July 2019 fuel cost to be about $750,000. So this is a request to exercise that last year of the agreement and add the funding to the
Commissioners, comments?
I just had a question about the diesel fuel. So this is bio, a percentage of this is biodiesel, and I forget what that's called. The number percentage is in the title.
Yeah,
of
there's two types of biofuels we're using. So biodiesel itself, we use a blend. It's called B5. So it's 5% biodiesel, and that's what's required under the renewable fuel standards in state law. So we are meeting it that way.
Yeah.
We tried a couple years
5%.
Ago. 5%.
It's 5%. Okay.
Well, we tried a couple years ago with something called R99. So we've changed the letter and changed the percentage.
Was that the palm?
That was the 100% renewable diesel.
So it meets the biofuel standard, but we can run it at 100% because it's essentially a drop-in replacement for, it's refined in the same way that regular diesel is.
And it was 99%?
99%. We were going to run it at 50% because there was a cost differential. We wanted to try to get the benefit without, you know, a really great cost difference. The problem is, as we finished our pilot, the availability of it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's so popular. California is using a ton of this renewable diesel, and they're really taking most of the supply that's available to us is going to California, where they have a much higher renewable mm-hmm. standard. And so they're going to pay that extra cost, and we just almost cannot get it. And if we can find some, it's about 70 cents a gallon more than the biodiesel is costing us. So
that's at the present time. It was 50% more when we did the pilot.
So California's not using biodiesel, even though it's a lot cheaper?
They're using biodiesel.
Putting a stress on the supplies?
They're putting a stress on the renewable diesel supply as well as the biodiesel supply.
Yeah, both. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So was palm oil what we were, was that part of the, what part of the R99?
Yes.
And that's like, I've been reading that's out of favor because of land use.
There's a lot of difference. So R99 can be palm oil, can be canola oil, can be other types of organic oils. It can also be animal fats, other waste fats and oils. And so the resource that we were buying it from was from Malaysia, which is where there's a company called Neste that has the largest refinery. And they were using palm oil, but they did what's called sustainably farmed palm oil. So they had to certify that it wasn't contributing to deforestation, and they go through a self-certification process. So we felt like we were being as conscientious as we could to getting responsible palm oil. What's happened is that we really need to get a U.S. manufacturer that's using some other feedstock in order for it to be at some level where we can afford to buy it, and it's worth the little bit of premium we would pay.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Other comments, questions? Okay, hearing none. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
And we've done 13.
We have, so we're up to item 14.
Okay.
A resolution approving proposed workforce changes to support ongoing river operations in preparation for termination of the Mid-Columbia Hourly Coordination Agreement. You may recall that we did a presentation for you a couple of weeks ago on this. We're not planning to do a new presentation today. This was just allowing you to have a little time to think about it. And, so folks are here to answer any questions you might have.
Morning, commissioners.
That was an easy presentation for you guys.
The science was definitely impressive. Any thoughts, comments, questions? I think it's been pretty well laid out.
Yeah.
Very good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
good
you.
To see you. Not often, but today was just kind of exceptional, you know? So we have resolutions 12 and 14.
I move approval, Mr. Chairman, of resolutions 12 and 14.
Is there a second? It's been moved and seconded to accept resolutions 12 and 14 as presented. Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of 12 and 14 signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Aye. Motions are carried. Ongoing to manager items. I believe there was one more.
Yeah, just have one left. So I wanted to report to you on a number of things that are going on in California. The public generating pool took a trip down to California a week ago Friday, met with the California ISO, Sacramento Utility District, and a lobbyist who works for California Public down there as well. This is the third time I've made a trip down there since I've been here. And I will tell you that it was interesting. It's the most welcome I have felt there. I never felt unwelcome before, but certainly the most welcome. And that had nothing to do with the personalities. That had everything to do with what's going on in the system in California, the challenges that they're having in terms of dealing with solar and wind and the increasing ramp in the afternoon. A few key takeaways from that. One, we have been actively tracking and last year even engaged some in the legislation around renewable portfolio standard in California, the increase that's proposed to go from 50% to 60% for renewables that does not include hydro. But the thing that troubled us more is that there was a goal set for going to 100% clean energy by 2045 that in one version of the bill specifically excluded hydro. And so we had engaged last year to put together material that showed what the value is, both of existing transactions as well as the potential for the future as the you deal with these increasing afternoon ramps as a result of the solar on the system. And felt like it was a worthwhile trip to go down and have that conversation. So this year, that bill is in play. The bill that would create regional governance of the California Independent System Operator, which means that today the governance is driven by the California governor, who nominates the board of the CAISO and approved by the state legislature. So we see that as problematic, because no one state should control the market formation for a Western electricity market. So that bill is in play.
Two separate bills so far, Steve?
Two separate bills.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
But the thing that has apparently made it more likely, although how likely people debate, that it might actually get addressed this year is the tremendous problems that they're having with wildfire liability for electric utilities. So big wildfires, both in Northern and Southern California, huge potential costs for particularly the investor-owned utilities there, and the way the liability law works makes it very difficult for them to defend, even if there was no negligence on the part of the utility. So utilities want something, the governor wants something, people are thinking that maybe a deal could get done. I think one of the things we heard was better chance of that happening than we realized before we went down. So we have, through PGP, re-engaged and someone who is an expert down there to help us make sure that our messages are being heard over the course of the next few weeks, because August is the key month for the California legislature to address any legislation for this year. Obviously, we're playing defense with respect to the Renewable Portfolio Standard Bill and trying to make sure that hydro is not excluded. But we're also interested in this regional governance bill, because there's a lot going on in the arena around market formation in the West. And our number one issue, the thing that has troubled us the most, is that it would be difficult to participate in something where the governance structure was being set by one state in the Western market. So I just want to make you aware we are engaged there. Well, we did see and talk quite a bit about how the evolution of the system is accelerating at rates above what the forecast were, that the afternoon ramps are between 12 to 15,000 megawatts, which is predicted for like 4 years from now, not for things that we'll be experiencing now. And that, you know, they are really trying to figure out how they can solve that problem quickly, which leaves them with very few options, because anything they have to build takes a while to build. And they have more retirements of their gas-fired units coming up in the next couple of years.
Wow.
And so they have an increase in the amount of non-hydro renewables and a decrease of their flexible resources occurring simultaneously. We engage some on an issue that we think is really important, resource adequacy, which is making sure that utilities have defined what their need is and are acquiring enough to meet their need, because we continue to believe that in this market, people are encouraged to buy in the short-term market and not think long-term, because the short-term markets are really low, and that undervalues capacity, and of course, we're a capacity provider. So the way to solve that is to have a strong resource adequacy standard, and we got some good advice about how to better engage on those issues in California. There is a significant issue going on around something called default energy bid, which is we've discovered, because hydro owners in the West who have joined the energy imbalance market are finding that they are bidding in their hydro at a price and being told by the market monitor that they have market power, which then the market monitor and the process that they've got decreases the bid price below what they offered. And because they bid in, they actually have to supply. So you lose control of your resource and you lose control of the price.
What's the term for that again?
Default energy bid. So it's an energy bid, but you get set to do it.
You get defaulted to that, yeah.
So, you know, we were clear with the folks that we were meeting with, this is unworkable for us, because you can't lose control of your pricing and your resource and be willing to participate in a market like that. Their worry on their side is there could be times when hydro owners are actually controlling the market and that we could set prices too high for consumers in California. I will tell you, this is a debate that's gone on for at least 30 years that I've personally been involved in since 1987. So it's not like there's a real clear solution out there between those two positions. But it is extremely important as we think about how these markets continue to evolve in the West. Final thing to make you aware of is there is a thing called the Reliability Coordinator, and it applies to the entire, or at least it has applied to the entire Western interconnection. You have to be a member, if you're a balancing authority, as we are, you have to be a part of a Reliability Coordinator services. We talked about this once before, you may recall. This is how you make sure that reliability isn't just impacted by the way you operate your balancing authority. You're impacted by everything around you. So somebody has to have visibility about the everything around you piece. That's the RC. There is an organization called PEAK that has provided that service for the last few years. People have been concerned about the cost of PEAK. The California Independent System Operator has offered to provide those services. There's been a big debate going on over the last year. Last week, PEAK announced that it will be winding down its operations and will be out of business by the end of 2019. They have been concerned about whether they had enough support to continue from their members. So that puts us in a position where there's, I wouldn't say no choice, but little choice in terms of where we'll go for RC services. The California Independent System Operator is going to provide it. The Southwest Power Pool will provide it, but they're a long way away, and there may not be many around us who are taking that service, so makes it difficult to consider it as a viable option. So we are headed towards now figuring out what it would take to participate in the CAISO Reliability Coordination Services. I wouldn't say this was completely unplanned work, because we've seen that there was a problem coming, but we had hoped that PEAK would survive and we'd be able to stay there. So this announcement definitely puts us into the mode of we're going to have to figure out how to, we will have to have a new RC, and we'll have to figure out how we integrate with that new reliability coordinator. So just wanted you to be aware that that's moving its way along, and people here are beginning to restructure work to make sure that we're going to be able to participate. Like I say, we don't have a choice. You can't say, well, I'm not going to do it. You'll be out of compliance with the reliability standard if you went down that path. So lots going on.
A little bit of a forced march.
It is a forced march. Yeah, because there are timelines around the PEAK going away, and then timelines in order to be able to make sure that you can integrate with your new RC.
Steve?
Yeah.
One of your comments that you made back a little bit really got my attention as it relates to people selling into the ISO, and then they made a bid and ultimately ended up having to be a price taker. The fruit industry has great experience with that, virtually all of it being negative. We used to sell fruit to the East Coast on consignment. In any way we can avoid that component, it's, you know, we need to avoid that if at all possible.
So while we are not participants in the energy imbalance market today, and that puts us a little bit on the outside of this conversation, we are actively tracking it. And when we visited with the CAISO, it was an important part of the conversation. And they understood that it would certainly influence our future decisions. So we're going to play, and we'll see how much influence we can have.
Always dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Other thoughts?
Well, let me just say, make sure that summarize that and say, so we've got some things going on that are really good for our price, and mm-hmm. we've got some things that are going on that are bad for our price. We're in that mode of trying to then figure out how you forecast prices from there.
How's the, I guess I'd be referring to Greg, but how's the spot market been in California with the weather recently. Pretty good. Yeah. I was very surprised at some of the gas prices last week. I mean, I don't know the last time I saw an 8 on that chart that was in the first place spot. It was kind of almost shocking.
Yeah, prices are very high today.
Yeah.
In the West Coast markets. Heat across the West.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I always thank my relatives in Southern California for the contributions. I believe they're quite generous for us.
Steve, thanks for that report. That's always very interesting, distressing, and interesting, and in all world into one.
Threats and opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was it for our manager items.
So we are at commissioner items. Commissioners, do we have an item or items?
I have one.
Please.
This will come as a request if it's feasible to do it. Over the last few weeks, I've had more than one contact with people talking about various properties that we, the PUD, own, and wondering what the what the PUD is going to do with those properties. And the thought occurred to me that never, as a commissioner, have I seen a layout of properties that we own, not along the Columbia, but in various places throughout the county. How difficult would it be to have maps of what we own? How expensive and difficult?
How about if we take that as an action item? My understanding was there was a discussion of this before I got here, so I'd like to go back and review that. I appreciate the way you asked that. Before asking us to do it, to ask us how much it would take to do it. So how about if we figure that out and get back to you?
Yeah, Commissioner, some time ago there was a real property inventory that was put together, not of property rights, but just fee interest in property. And I don't know that that's been translated to a map.
I remember that too.
Yeah, that was the effort that Steve's referring to. I just don't know if that identification has become a map that would be able to show on GIS. I know that, I mean, it's, I want to say it's north of 500 properties that we own.
Yeah, and I think it was somewhat prompted by encroachment and other kinds of issues that we just needed to have a much more clear picture in terms of where we were and what was what. So again, I would concur with the statement of being able to ask how much it costs, but I would support the interest if it's feasible and it's worth time.
Quick commission item. Rebecca, as long as you're here and I'm here, will you put on our agenda for the commissioner workshop in October? Just add me onto that agenda for a short discussion on safety, some ideas that some folks shared with me, especially related to the fatality at Rock Island. And put 5 minutes beside it, and then put a dash, and then put 25 minutes. I mean, who knows where, how much time we'll devote to it.
And I shared with Ann this noon that we have not started building that agenda, but it's certainly time to do so. So what I would prefer, just in terms of procedure, is go ahead, and not because I want to be a control freak, but just kind of run them through me, and then we'll get them to Rebecca and get them on, and so we have a reasonable time frame and opportunity to get to those things that we think are important, and if we need to prioritize, then that'll give us something to work with. But thank you for the process. Anything else?
And if you put me anywhere, put me at the end. I don't care. It doesn't matter.
I can do that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Follow-up on delegation of action items?
So we had two, but they were both identified as things that we would get back to you later on. So I'm just going to say we're still working away on those, and we'll get back to you in the time frame we had described.
And 18?
So we have two follow-ups from today. Number one, on the cryptocurrency, how will applications be processed once the moratorium is lifted, what order, all those kinds of questions. So we'll do more work on that. And then the one that just came up, the what would it take to do the work to look at the properties that we have that are being underutilized?
Yeah. Okay.
So I would just say that's like how we do that now. We've never done that before. We haven't done that pre-Steve, right? It's a checks and balances, in a way. I think it's great, the action items. Pre, or the, you know, the from the previous meeting and then today's action item. It's great.
Well, it's helpful for us, too, because it's clear accountability.
Yeah.
Right, so what are we accountable for?
I think that's what Kathy, was it Kathy Melton, who really stressed in her report, clear and concise. Her report was clear and concise, and that was the theme throughout her report for the integrated resource plan, and that's perfect. Clear and concise is great, essential.
Okay. Since there's no public, I'm assuming we have no additional public comment. And matters of number 20, matters of general business.
You have one proposed motion, Commissioner, setting an HPI training for the board on August 20th, special meeting.
Yeah. You know what?
Should be in your packet.
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I move to set a special meeting on August 20th, 2018, at 8:30 a.m. in the second floor conference room of the headquarters building, 327 North Wenatchee Avenue, for the purpose of human performance initiative training.
There's a motion on the floor. Is there a second?
You second.
So, sorry. I was trying to find it on my calendar. Yes, I second that.
It's kind of the same thing I'm doing. It's like, hey, take your time. I just want to make.
Is that for 1 hour?
I thought it was 8:30.
I'm sorry. We don't have the right people in the room to answer that question.
Okay. Just good. 1 hour. Approximately
yes.
1 hour.
Yeah, it is okay. 1 hour.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. There's a motion on the floor to set a special meeting August 20th, 2018 at 8:30 a.m. Second floor conference room in the headquarters building, 327 North Wenatchee Avenue, for the purpose of human performance initiative training. It's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No. Motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, and thanks for bringing that up. Well, we've got to add that. Are you going to put them on? Okay, thank you. Then I won't fat finger it. I appreciate it. executive session?
We'll say 60 minutes.
60 minutes. Executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions. I wrote right over the top of it. what's the word at the end of the first sentence?
Litigation.
Litigation. Thank you. A clean version. Thank you. Potential litigation to which the district or its board is likely or is likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I to consider the selection of a site for the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101B to consider the minimum price set at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause likelihood of decreased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101C for approximately 60 minutes. So we're somewhere right around 1:30. We'll be somewhere right around in the 2:30 range. The Chelan County Board of Directors, July 23rd, coming out of executive session. It is 2:13, and there is no other business to be conducted, so the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.